Hey, we're into a study here of Genesis, and we're going to finish this book tonight. We'll be flying again like we were last time, because we're going about 8 chapters in one sitting. All about this guy named Joseph. A little profile, interesting guy. He was his dad's favorite son, which mattered in a family with 12 sons in it. And he was a son of Rachel. She was the one that Jacob wanted to marry. Remember, Leah was the one he got stuck with. But this was the first son that she was able to have, and she had him late in life. So he was a favorite. He was handsome. We read that he was fair in face and also in form. He was built. Brilliant guy. It's clear that he was smarter than the people around him. Well built, he was a hunk, charismatic, he was one of these guys. Any situation we find him in, he immediately rises to the top and seems to be, people just recognize him as a leader. Also spiritually gifted, he had the ability to even predict the future and all kinds of very deep insight spiritually. And yet his life was a life of pain and of confusion. Why would that happen to someone like this? Let's read through this story and see what we can get. We read in chapter 37 that Jacob settled again in the land of Canaan, where his father had lived. That's Joseph's dad. We're down 3 generations now. This is the history of Jacob's family. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flocks with his half-brothers. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. So he ratted out his brothers, and you know, that doesn't sit too well in most brotherhoods. Tattletale. We read that Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day he gave Joseph a special gift, a beautiful robe, a coat of many colors. Something that was very expensive in that time with hand looming. And that really angered his brothers. His brothers hated Joseph because of their father's partiality. They couldn't say a kind word to him. Well, one night, Joseph has a dream and promptly reported the details to his brothers, causing them to hate him even more. Why? Listen to the dream, he announced. He says, "We were out in the field tying up bundles of grain. My bundle stood up, and then your bundles gathered around and bowed low before it." Think about that one. "Oh, so you're going to be our king, are you?" his older brothers taunted. And they hated him all the more for his dream and what he had said. Then Joseph had another dream. Told his brothers about that one too. Listen to this one, he says. "The sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed low before me." So he's not too tactful. He doesn't have too much diplomacy going for him, does he? And it turns out that these dreams are actually prophetic. This literally happens. But of course, he didn't have to go telling them about it anyway. This time he told his father as well as his brothers, and his father rebuked him. "Oh, what do you mean?" his father asked. "Will your mother, your brothers, and I actually come and bow down before you?" Well, some time passes, and this is all setting the stage for why Joseph's brothers didn't like him. Jealous and offended. So a little later, Jacob says to Joseph, "Your brothers are out over at Shechem with the flocks. I'm going to send you out to them." Joseph's like, "I'm ready to go." When Joseph's brothers saw him coming, he's 17 years old now, they recognize him in the distance and they made plans to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they exclaim. "Come on, let's kill him and throw him into a deep pit. And we can tell our father that a wild animal's eating him. Then we'll see what comes of these dreams." But Reuben, the oldest, came to Joseph's rescue. "Now, let's not kill him," he said. "Why should we shed his blood? Let's just throw him alive into this pit here, and that way he'll die without our having to touch him." Well, the text reveals that Reuben was actually planning to later sneak in and get him and rescue him from his other brothers, but he didn't want to say that. So when Joseph arrived, they pull off his beautiful robe and threw him into the pit. A pit normally used to store water, but it was empty at this. So it's a cistern, one of these big cisterns they build over there. Then, just as they were sitting down to eat, they noticed a caravan of camels in the distance coming toward them. It was a group of Ishmaelite traders taking on spices, balm, and myrrh from Gilead down to Egypt. Judah said to the others, "Hey, what can we gain by killing our brother? That just gives us a guilty conscience. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelite traders. We won't have a guilty conscience about that. Sell him as a slave. That way we won't be responsible for his death. After all, he is our brother." And of course, we get some money out of this too. So his brothers agreed. Then Joseph's brothers killed a goat, and they dipped his robe in the goat's blood. And took the beautiful robe to their father and asked him to identify it. "We found this in the field," they told him. Is this Joseph's robe?" And the father recognized it at once. "Yes," he says, "it's my son's robe. A wild animal has attacked and eaten him. Surely Joseph has been torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his clothes and put on sackcloth. He mourned deeply for his son for many days. Well, when Joseph arrived in Egypt, now where the caravan gets down to Egypt, and we read that he was purchased by Potiphar, a member of the personal staff of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Potiphar was the captain of the palace guard, so he is the slave of an Egyptian official now. The Lord was with Joseph and blessed him greatly as he served in the house of the Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this, and he realized the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything that he did. So Joseph naturally became quite a favorite with him. Potiphar soon put Joseph in charge of his entire household and entrusted him with all of his business dealings. He's like the second in command there, you know, the steward of the house. Now, Joseph was very handsome and a well-built young man. He was hot. And about this time, Potiphar's wife began to desire him and invited him to sleep with her. But Joseph refused. "Look," he told her, "my master trusts me with everything in his entire household. No one here has more authority than I do. He's held back nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How could I ever do such a wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God." So we see some integrity in Joseph here. She kept putting on pressure day after day, chasing him around. But he refused to sleep with her, and he kept out of her way as much as possible. One day, however, no one else was around when he was doing his work inside the house. She came and grabbed him by his shirt, demanding, "Sleep with me." The old direct approach. She'd fit in pretty well in some of the clubs I've been in. Joseph tore himself away, but as he did, his shirt came off. Literally, she just clings to him and tears the shirt off his back. She was left holding it as he ran from the house. When she saw that she had his shirt and that he had fled, she got PO'd. And you know the saying, "Beware the wrath of a woman scorned." She began screaming. Soon, all the men of the palace came running. "My husband's brought this Hebrew slave to insult us," she sobbed. "He tried to rape me, but I screamed. And when he heard my loud cries, then he ran away, but he left the shirt here with me." And so she's got the shirt as evidence of an attempted rape. Well, after hearing his wife's story, Potiphar was furious. He took Joseph and threw him into prison where the king's prisoners were held. How long for? Till he changed his mind. Joseph's a slave, he doesn't have any rights, and she didn't even need the shirt as evidence. Just her say-so would have been enough to get him jailed. But we read the Lord was with Joseph. Read that again. There too. And he granted Joseph favor with the chief jailer. So he rose to the top in his family. He rose to the top with Potiphar. Now he's in jail. He rises to the top there. We read that before long, the jailer put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and over everything that happened in the prison. Something about this guy that made people feel like they could trust him. The chief jailer had no more worries after that because Joseph took care of everything. He's like a manager for the CEO. The Lord was with him, making everything run smoothly and successfully. Sometime later, Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and chief baker offended him. Bad move. Pharaoh became very angry with these officials, and he put them in prison where Joseph happened to be, in the same palace of Potiphar, the captain of the guard. They remained in prison for quite some time, and Potiphar assigned Joseph to take care of them, of course. One night, the cupbearer and the baker each had a dream, and each dream had its own meaning. And so they go on to relate, you know, the dream. We're skipping ahead here. And Joseph, turns out he can interpret dreams. So he says, well, here's what it means. To the cupbearer, he says, within 3 days, Pharaoh's going to take you out of prison and return you to your position as his chief cupbearer. To the other guy, he says, you're going to get your head lifted as well, right off your body. So that one didn't go so well. And he says, when you get there, when you get back in the palace of Pharaoh, please have some pity on me when you're back in his favor and mention me to Pharaoh and ask him to let me out of here. I was kidnapped from my homeland, the land of the Hebrews, and now I'm in here in jail and I did nothing to deserve it. Pharaoh's cupbearer, however, promptly forgot all about Joseph and never giving him another thought. Well, you know, you get out there, Pharaoh's court, and what, you're going to bother Pharaoh with some story about this guy down in jail that needs a break? You don't want to go irritating Pharaoh. You saw what happened last time, didn't it? So, of course, there just wasn't anything in it for him to say anything about Joseph. And so we read that 2 more years pass. Looking at the chronological notes that come up in this account, the best estimate for the amount of time that has passed now from the time that Joseph was sold into slavery until the end of these 2 years is probably 13 years of utter futility. This was an incredible trial, a series of trials, deepening trials, for Joseph. And in some ways, this last one must have been the worst. You know, to think, hey, God's moving. He gave me an interpretation of these dreams. There's something supernatural happening, and both the dreams came true. God must be working here. And then to just sit there month after month after month and just start to realize it's not going to happen. 2 whole years go by. This must have been the lowest time in Joseph's life right here. You can imagine his struggles. If you put yourself in his position and just imagine if your life had gone like this. I mean, yeah, maybe he shouldn't have, you know, shared his dreams with his brothers, but my gosh, he was a teenager, you know? He didn't have that much judgment back then. He certainly hadn't done anything wrong, really, to deserve being sold into slavery. He hadn't done anything wrong. Potiphar's, he did the right thing by refusing to sleep with a woman. By holding his integrity, that's what got him thrown into jail, by following God's will. And now that he's been in jail, doing his best, trying to follow God still, and there's evidence of that, for instance, when these guys say, hey, we need someone to interpret our dream, he says, well, I can't interpret it for you, but God will give you an interpretation. And it's clear, he still thinks in those terms. He's still loyal to Lord God. And now to just sit languishing and to be completely forgotten by this guy. I would think that despair would be very easy to fall into at this point. I could imagine myself absolutely despairing. And 2, unbelief. Where is God? I try to put God first. I try to be loyal to God. Look what's happening to my life. I'm a 30-year-old man now. Most of my adult life has gone by in servitude and prison and everything else. And the only thing I've tried to do is the right thing the whole way through. I could see hate and bitterness. Oh, yeah. Those brothers, those half-brothers of mine, man. Believe they sold me into slavery. And that woman, that witch, I mean. And then this guy, this knucklehead. I told him what his dream meant. I gave him what he wanted, and now he won't even try to get me out of here. And you could just see a heart of resentment and bitterness because Joseph is an abuse victim, isn't he? Just like some of us here. And people really get hung up on this. I mean, when people mess you over, particularly in successive waves, you can just get to the point where a lot of bitterness can build up in your heart. we find, though, even though there's been such a negative sequence of events in his life, God's not done. The story goes on. After these 2 years had gone by, Pharaoh also had a dream. And he dreamed that he was standing on the bank of the Nile River. In his dream, 7 fat, healthy-looking cows suddenly came up out of the river and began grazing along its bank. And then 7 other cows came up from the river, but these were ugly and gaunt, skinny. These cows went over and stood beside the fat cows. Then the thin cows ate the fat ones up. And at this point in the dream, Pharaoh woke up. He's thinking, man, this dream really bothered him a lot. He was convinced that there was something to it, that this meant something. He got his wise men, he got his wizards, and he says, what does this dream mean? They were all stumped. They were mystified. Well, we don't get it. They can't figure it out. All of a sudden, guess who's standing there listening to all of this go on? Oh, Mr. Cupbearer. He's right there. And so we read that he speaks up finally, and he says, today I've been reminded of my failure, he said. And he tells how when I was in prison, there was a guy there that could interpret dreams. He told me mine, he told the cook his, and they both came true exactly like he said. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph at once, and he was brought hastily from the dungeon. After a quick shave and a change of clothes, he went in and stood in Pharaoh's presence. Not a shave like one of our shaves. This was Egyptian-style shaving. The whole thing. Okay, they shaved the body, head, body hair, everything. Because the Egyptians had a real hang-up about cleanliness and lice. And they believed that hair was just bad for you. So particularly nobility in Egypt were shaven bald. And that's what they did with Joseph. Made him look like an Egyptian and then brought him into Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, well, I had a dream last night, and none of these men can tell me what it means, but I've heard that you can interpret dreams, and that's what I'll call you for. Well, Joseph says, well, actually, you heard wrong. He says, it's beyond my power to do this, but God will tell what it means, and he will set you at ease. Isn't that interesting? After all this, Joseph still is intent on giving all the glory for what he does to God. He won't take credit for it himself. And even in front of Pharaoh himself, where you really don't want to say unnecessary things, he feels it necessary to put this little caveat in. And so he goes on, Pharaoh tells him the dream, and he's sitting there like, yeah, I thought so. He knows it. He explains, these 7 fat cows, it's the next 7 years will be a period of great prosperity throughout the land of Egypt. But afterwards, there will be 7 years of famine so great that all the prosperity will be forgotten and wiped out, and famine will destroy the land. That's the 7 skinny cows eating the big fat cows. This famine, he says, will be so terrible that even the memory of the good years will be erased. And so Pharaoh's like, man, that sounds right. I resonate. He senses this is right. He says, I wonder what we should do. And Joseph's like, well, actually, I think you should find, first of all, the wisest man in Egypt and put him in charge of a nationwide program. Let the Pharaoh appoint officials over the land and let them go out and collect 1/5 of the crops during the 7 years that are good years. And put them in the storehouses of the Pharaoh. They put them in these royal storehouses. That way, it'll all be sitting there ready for the 7 years of famine. And there'll be enough to eat when the 7 years of famine come. Otherwise, disaster will surely strike the land and all the people will die during this famine if we don't plan ahead for it. Well, we read that Joseph's suggestion were well received by Pharaoh and by his advisors. I'm like, oh, sounds good. Can't go wrong with that. And so then they began to discuss and wonder who should be appointed for the job. But Pharaoh says, who could do it better than Joseph? He's the one that figured it out. After all, he's a man who obviously is filled with the Spirit of God. And so, turning to Joseph, Pharaoh says, since God has revealed the meaning of the dreams to you, you are the wisest man in the land. I hereby appoint you to direct this project. You will manage my household and organize all my people. Only I will have a higher rank than you. Whoa. Well, things turn around pretty quick sometimes, don't they? He's gone from a forgotten, miserable prisoner in a dungeon, a hopeless state, All of a sudden, he's the second leading guy in Egypt, the greatest empire in the world at that time. Meanwhile, back in Israel, we'll just fast forward a little bit, up where his family is. They go through the 7 years. Huge amounts of grain are collected in Egypt. Everybody's real happy about the program because Pharaoh, you know, is like getting rich out of this too. But then the 7 years pass and the famine years begin. Happens just like it was predicted. When Jacob heard, this is his dad now again, heard there was grain available down in Egypt, he said to his sons, "What are you standing around looking at one another? I've heard there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us before we all starve to death." And so Joseph's 10 older brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain. Jacob wouldn't let Joseph's younger brother, there was one last brother, younger even than Joseph, named Benjamin, go with them, however, for fear that some harm might come to him. Benjamin was also a son of Rachel. See, the other guys were all sons of Leah or some concubines, but they were not. Rachel was the one he really loved, so that's, they were jealous of the two youngest sons. Jacob would not let Benjamin go with him. Benjamin probably still pretty young right now. Anyway, Jacob's sons arrive in Egypt along with the others to buy food for the famine had reached Canaan as well. And since Joseph was the governor of all of Egypt and in charge of the sale of grain, it was to him that his brothers came, and they walk in and bow down low before him. Well, well, well. Here we are. This is really exactly what he dreamed, isn't it? And the thing is, they have no idea it's him. See, he was a boy when they saw him last. Now he's a full-grown man, shaven, wearing Egyptian garb, and they even had the eye makeup. You've seen the little eye swirl they put on and stuff like that. He looks nothing like anyone they've ever seen. He's speaking through a translator to them. And so they have no idea that it's Joseph, but he immediately knew that it was them. Joseph recognized them instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger. "Where are you from?" he demanded roughly. "Well, we're from the land of Canaan," they replied. "We've come down to buy some grain from you guys." Joseph's brothers didn't recognize him, but Joseph did recognize them. And he remembered the dreams he had had many years before. He said to them, "You guys are spies. You've come in here to see how vulnerable our land has become. You're scouts for some invading army, aren't you?" "No, no, my lord," they exclaimed. "We just came to buy some food." "We're all brothers and honest men, sir. We're not spies." "Yes, you are," he insisted. "You come in here to discover how vulnerable the famine has made us." "Sir," they said, "no. There's 12 of us brothers, and our father's in the land of Canaan. Our youngest brother's there with our father, and one of our brothers no longer with us." "Oh, is that a fact?" Joseph insisted. "As I said, you guys are spies, and you're going to suffer the penalty." And then they're like, "We're telling the truth." He says, "Really? You're telling the truth?" "Yes, we're telling the truth." "Really?" "Yes." And they go back and forth, and he finally says, "Okay, I'm going to test you. We'll find out whether you're telling the truth. I swear by the life of Pharaoh that you will not leave Egypt unless your youngest brother comes here. Why don't you go and get your brother, and I'll keep the rest of you here bound in prison. Then we'll find out whether or not your story's true. If it turns out that you don't have a younger brother, then I'll know that you're spies and treat you accordingly." So he put them all in prison for 3 days. Well, seemed to have changed his mind a little bit. Came back on the third day, Joseph said to them, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'm a God-fearing man. If you do as I say, I'm going to let you live." He says, "We'll see how honorable you really are. Only one of you will remain in prison, and the rest of you can go on home with grain for your families." So he's really setting up a situation where the rest of you can benefit, and all you have to do is forfeit one of your brothers. Just like you did before. And he's kind of skillfully set up a little test here. Let's try it again. He's kind of wondering, "I wonder if anything's changed in the decade and a half since the last time we dealt with each other." He says, but you guys bring your younger brother back to me, and in this way I'll know whether or not you're telling me the truth. And if you are, I'll spare you. And they agreed to that. Well, they go speaking among themselves, still in the room, speaking in Hebrew to each other, thinking he can't understand what they're saying. And they are saying to each other, this all happened because of what we did to Joseph a long time ago. We saw his terror and anguish, and we heard his pleadings, but we wouldn't listen. That's why this trouble has come upon us. Didn't I tell you not to do it? Reuben asks. But you wouldn't listen. And now we're going to die because we murdered him. Of course, they think he's dead. Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them as he was standing there because he had been speaking to them through an interpreter. So they had no idea that he could speak Hebrew. And at this point, he leaves the room and found a place where he could weep. He's moved in his heart deeply. He didn't want them to see that he was affected by what they said. Returning, he talked some more with them. And then he chose Simeon from among them and had him tied up right in front of their eyes. They get to see him bound and taken away to show that he means business. Joseph then ordered his servants to fill the men's sack with grain, but he also gave them secret instructions to return each brother's money at the top of his sack. He also gave them provisions for their journey back home. So they loaded up their donkeys with the grain and they started for home. But when they stopped for the night, one of them opened his sack to get some grain to feed the donkeys, and he found the money in his sack. Look, he exclaimed to his brothers, my money's right here in my sack. And they were filled with terror and said to each other, what has God done to us? Because they're thinking to themselves, man, we're going to see some chariots riding us down any time now, and they're going to come out here and say that we stole this money. And we didn't. Somebody must have made a mistake or something. Well, they get home, finally, with the grain. Nobody chases them. And they tell Jacob, Grandpa, what happened. And they're telling him, you know, we got to take Benjamin back there and get Simeon out of jail. And of course, Jacob's not really too excited about that whole project. Jacob exclaimed, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph has disappeared. Simeon's gone now. And now you want to take Benjamin too? Everything's going against me, he says. That's the way it really looked to Jacob. You could see how he would get that. You know, Jacob's kind of had a hard time of it, too. There's nothing worse than losing a child. The sorrow, especially somebody that he loved as deeply as he did Joseph. And now he's being told, you have to give up this other child that's the child of your old age, the child that he placed so much value on in order to save the life of one of your other kids. Good chance, they said, you know, I'm sure they were telling him that bald guy down there was mean. And this guy meant business. And he first urges them, just go back and get him yourselves. And they're like, I'm not going back in front of that guy without this kid here. He told us not to show up without. And Jacob just is disgusted. He refuses to give up Benjamin to go back. He's like, I've already lost enough. And so they sit. But we read that there was no relief from the terrible famine throughout the year. Lo and behold, another harvest comes and there's nothing there. Can't harvest any food. The hunger became so severe, he realized, I'm going to lose all my kids if I don't do something. And so he makes the decision. Jacob said to his sons, come on, go down there and buy us some more food. But Judah's like, hey, that guy, the bald guy, said that we can't go down there. And he warned us that we should not see him again without Benjamin being along. He says, if you let him come with us, we'll go down and buy some food. But if you don't let Benjamin go, we may as well stay at home. Remember, that man said, you won't be allowed to come to see me unless your brother's with you. Oh, why did you even tell him that you had another brother? Jacob says, why did you have to treat me with such cruelty? And of course, they're like, look, the man specifically asked about our family, they replied. He wanted to know whether our father was still living. He asked if we had another brother so we could. So we told him, how do we know he was going to say, bring him here? Good point. They just blundered into this one. Well, finally, he's like, you know, he succumbs to the inevitable. He gives them his youngest son. Take him down. He says, may God Almighty give you mercy as you go before the man. this bald man down there, and that he might release Simeon and return Benjamin. And if I must bear the anguish of their deaths, then so be it. And so he watches them take off, now with yet his last son. And great sorrow and misery was on the heart of Jacob at this time. You can well imagine the sad things that had happened to this old guy. He lost Joseph. No protection from that famine. You know, God, weren't you the one that said you were going to take care of us and that you would, make sure that we did well? Why aren't we being protected from the famine? Why can't we get any food out of the earth? Boy, this would be tempting for some unbelief right here, wouldn't it? Now I lost Simeon, I lost another son, I'm probably going to lose Benjamin too. Boy, you could sit down right here and have a pretty severe self-pity party. Not to mention a little righteous blasphemy of God. It wouldn't be hard to imagine someone having that reaction. Of course, all of his impressions were wrong. Each and every conclusion that he reached was mistaken. Joseph was not dead. He was down ruling the land of Egypt right now. God was protecting them from the famine, and as a matter of fact, through this process, would eventually lead them into one of the most fertile spots on earth in the Nile Delta, where they would be turned from a family into an entire nation in that spot. And he was using this famine to pressure them to move down there. Simeon was not lost either. He would soon be released. And of course, Benjamin never got lost. But it looked this way. If you look at it from Jacob's eyes, as he sees the caravan go over the hill in the distance, this is the way it looked. Wrong, 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 and wrong. And there's something to think about there. It's kind of similar to what we saw with Joseph earlier, huh? Today, you know, people like to say that, you know, well, I just go by what I feel, you know. All I know is what I feel. And, you know, I just believe, you know, if you ask some people, they say, what do you believe? And they're like, well, I just think this and this. And they're like, yeah, why is that? Well, I just feel that. So we figure, you know, if we feel it, well, then that's the way it is. You know, it's like truth. The truth is inside my head. It's not the truth out there that matters. It's like, what's truth to me? That's what matters. That's typical postmodern thinking. Now, if you took that approach in this situation, you would have run into a serious problem, wouldn't you? Because Jacob had good reason to feel and to believe all these things, and yet none of them were true in the real world out there. And as a matter of fact, God thinks that our feelings are very limited. And we will run into this situation today, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian here today. We'll often run into situations where we just feel that things are going a certain way, and we just feel that things are a certain way, and that certain things are inevitable, and we just really feel that way. And so we believe it. And it's very possible that each and everything that we feel is true is false. Yes. God's purposes in our lives often can't be seen right away. And none of these people, now Joseph, we'll see, was starting to get it. But none of these other people were able to see at this stage what God was doing. That was a complete blank wall there. It seemed to be nonsense. Well, they go back to Joseph, this time with Benjamin in company. When Joseph saw that Benjamin was with him, he said to the manager of his household, "These men will eat with me this noon. Take them inside and prepare a big feast." Well, the brothers were badly frightened when they saw that they were being taken to a feast. Oh, man, he wants to see us. He wants to spend more time with us. It's because of the money was returned in our sacks. That's it. He thinks that he's going to charge us with stealing and pretend that we stole that money, because this guy has it in for us. Then he's going to seize us as slaves, and he's going to take our donkeys. That's it. He wants the donkeys. The ruler of Egypt is going to get some donkeys for himself. Well, they're way off. He asks them, when they come into the dinner, they ask them how they've been getting along. And he said, "So how's your father, the old man that you spoke about? Is he still alive?" "Yeah," they replied, "he's alive and well." And then they bowed again before him, just like before. Looking at his brother, Benjamin, Joseph asked, "Is this your younger brother, the one you told me about?" And he says, "May God be gracious to you, my son." Then Joseph had to make a hasty exit because he was overcome with emotion for his brother and wanted to cry again. Going into his private room, he wept there, but he didn't want them to see it. He gets himself together. He comes back into the meal. Joseph ate over by himself, and his brothers were served at a separate table. That's the Egyptians sat with Joseph at his table because Egyptians despise Hebrews and refuse to eat with them. Now, that's an interesting point, and it becomes important later in this story. It's very true, too, that Egyptians had a very xenophobic attitude. They did not like foreigners at all, particularly with Hebrews and goat herders, herdsmen. They felt they were dirty, and they didn't want to be around them. Well, I'll explain why this becomes significant later. When his brothers were ready to leave, Joseph gave these instructions to the man in charge of his own household. "Fill each of their sacks with much grain as they can carry, and put each man's money back into his sack. Then put my personal silver cup at the top of the youngest brother's sack, along with his grain money." So the household manager did as he was told. Joseph's going to test them one last time. He's thinking maybe these guys have changed, but he's going to check again. Because after all, last time, it was Simeon, and this Benjamin, now he would be analogous to Joseph in the sense that this is the one they're going to be jealous of, if any of them are. So he's going to pull a little thing here and just see. He's partly testing to see whether his brothers have learned anything from the sin they committed earlier. And he's also engaged here in an act of discipline where he's basically chastising them for what they did. Well, he says to put his silver cup, a piece of treasure, into the youngest man's sack. And then after they leave, he sends his cops out. They chase him down out in the desert and encircle them with chariots. They get out and said, "I can't believe you stole the master's silver cup that he uses for divining." And they're like, "We never stole any cup. That's a lie." And they speak up and say, "If you find that cup anywhere in our luggage here, let the man who has it die, and the rest of us will become your master's slaves forever. That's how sure we are that we didn't steal nothing." "Fair enough," the man replied, "except that only the one with that stola will be a slave. The rest of you can go free. We're not going to hold you all guilty for it." Well, they quickly took their sacks from the back of the donkeys and opened them up. Joseph's servant began searching from the oldest brother's sack, going down the line to the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. "Whoa, what do we have here?" And they're just there like, "Oh, no, 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 yeah, let's go." And they take him back, but the brothers are like, "We're going too." And so the whole troop comes tramping back to Joseph once again. Judah, the oldest brother, says, "Oh, my Lord, what can we say to you? How can we plead? How can we prove our innocence? God is punishing us for our sins. My Lord, we've all returned to be your slaves, we and our brother who had your cup in his sack." And Joseph's like, "No, no, only the one who stole the cup will be my slave. The rest of you can go back to your father." So there it is. Just expunge one of your brothers. You guys can have your freedom and your grain. Go back, have a good life. No problem. He rolls the carpet out and basically says, "There it is." Well, this time comes up and pleads with him, "Please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers." Well, there is a shift of attitude there, isn't there? "How can I return to my father if the boy is not with me? I cannot bear to see what this will do to him." And so it's clear that these guys have gotten out of their immature and petty jealousy. Joseph has seen all he needs to see. Joseph could stand it no longer.
"Out, all of you," he cried to his attendants. And all the Egyptians file out. He wanted to be alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. And then he broke down and wept aloud, and his sobs could be heard throughout the palace, and the news was quickly carried to Pharaoh's palace. "I am Joseph," he said to his brothers. "Is my father still alive?" But his brothers were speechless. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. Whew. What a moment this must have been. They're just standing there, just locked up. You know, it's like smoke is coming out of their ears. It's like, okay, wait a minute. The bald guy just spoke to us in Hebrew. No, that can't be. Yeah, it is. Well, you talk about a paradigm shift. These guys were shifting so hard it was burning out the clutch. They're just astonished. "Come over here," he said, and they came closer, and he said again, "I am Joseph, your brother who you sold into Egypt." And they're just like, "Oh, my God." He says, "Don't be angry with yourselves that you did this to me, for God did it." It was really God. He said, "He sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives." Well, isn't that interesting? And there's a different perspective on things right there. Instead of this horizontal perspective and blaming the people that had messed him over, instead of wallowing in hate and bitterness that so reasonably could have come over and taken over his life, Joseph has worked this all out, and he's basically has realized, so really God has had everything under control the whole time. God never forsook me. That never happened. This plan, it took a long time to unfold, but it's all becoming clear. He explains, he says, "These 2 years of famine we've had will grow to 7, during which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God has sent me here to keep you and your families alive so that you'll become a great nation." These famines in the ancient world were very severe. We have clear evidence of just wholesale death that would wipe out entire populations. There was no international grain bank, UN, or anything else that would help people. They usually could not even store from 1 year to the next grain in most countries. And so that's why the human population has remained stable for tens of thousands of years. It's because of huge die-offs that happen periodically. Shortage of food. And he says, this is a whopper. This one's going to be bad. And God saw all of this coming, but he's made a move here. And he's brought you down here, and he's brought me up in this position I'm in so I can preserve your lives. Yes, it was God who sent me here, not you. Wow. And he has made me a counselor to Pharaoh, manager of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Hurry, return to my father and tell him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me master over all the land of Egypt. Come down to me right away. Man, I wish we had that scene where they went back up and said, this bald guy turns out to be Joseph. Of course, they would have to say, and he'd be like, how did he get into Egypt? Well, you see, Dad. So I guess some confession had to happen there. But man, can you imagine Jacob's excitement when he learned, my son is alive after all. After all these years, he did not die. He's down there. And they saddle him up, and the whole clan comes down. About 70 people come down now with all their households and everything. Joseph tells them, you guys are going to live in the land of Goshen, so you can be near me with all your household and grandchildren, your flocks and your herds and everything that you have. I'll take care of you there, for there's still 5 more years of famine ahead of us. Otherwise, you and your household would come to utter poverty, and indeed, many would die. Well, we read in chapter 45, verse 18, Pharaoh gave them the best piece of land around. It's a chunk right up in the Nile Delta there, where the Nile splits out into Forks, and one of those pieces in there is called Goshen, and that's where they were. This is all delta soil, well-watered. Oh, man, you couldn't pick a better place probably in the Near East to live than right there in Goshen. And there were other things that happened as well as a result of this. In the years that followed, God multiplied the people of Israel from a family into a nation of 1.5 million by the 430 years later when they came out of Egypt. This had turned into a nation. The Egyptians also, and here's the key point. Remember how we read that the Egyptians didn't like Hebrews and wanted nothing to do with them. And that was the Egyptian attitude. Totally different than the Canaanite attitude. The Canaanites liked them. They were intermarrying with them. They were hanging out with them. And so the belief system, the nature worship, all of the superstition that the Canaanites had was rubbing off on them as well. As they seem to have had very little resistance to syncretism, to the mixing of what God had taught them with these nature religions. And it was a threat to their actual identity and survival. Down in Egypt, though, nobody would touch them with a 10-foot pole. And that's exactly what God needed, basically to incubate this people long enough to become a nation without being, as it were, ideologically overrun by some of the raunchiest religious worldviews in the world at that time. And so, yes, looks like God made a move here. And the way this the whole story ended up turned out to be pretty good after all. And so we need to think about, how does a story like this apply to you and me? We got to think about all those years when it was really not only difficult to see what God was doing. Not just difficult, folks. It was impossible. No amount of insight, as Joe lay languishing in that dungeon, no depth of thought could have brought him to, you know, maybe God is going to make me the leader of Egypt someday. And maybe that way I could save people from famine or something like that. It was impossible for him to know what was going to happen during all of those years. And yet he never forsook God. Even when he was brought in at the end there before Pharaoh, he's laying it down straight up. I'm with God, and whatever happens, that's him that does that. So incredible loyalty in the face of apparent disaster. Now, I don't know that many of us will have to go to any kind of an extreme like what we see here with Joseph. I never have. But I can identify with that kind of situation where it just seems like, you know, God, where are you? I've been forsaken here. Everything's going wrong. Like what Jacob said. Everything's against me. You ever had that? And you get this feeling like, you know, God's not answering my prayers. I'm just on a spiral here, a negative spiral. I'm in a situation that's so awful. You know, if God was real, I wouldn't be in a situation like this. That's what we think. I think Joseph could have reached that conclusion really easy. You know, the fact of the matter is that understanding God's purpose in your life is not like opening a fortune cookie. Wouldn't that be nice if we could just go down and get a little fortune cookie and find, oh, so that's what God's doing here. It ain't that easy, folks. Truthfully, the deep things of God are only available to people who are prepared to stand fire for Him over the long haul. God reveals His purpose to those who are faithful enough to stand in there with Him. And often, that can take quite a while. Let's hope it doesn't take 13 years of uninterrupted suffering and disaster. But who's to say? And so we realize, each one of us sitting here tonight, that the Bible declares God has a purpose for your life. Now that's a pretty important proposition right there. I don't know what would matter more than that. You start talking about God the Creator knows you. Jesus said He knows you so well He could number the hairs on your head. God is not, you're not at all lost in the crowd. God knows exactly who you are. And so there's a purpose there that He has in mind for your life. But the question is, are we ever going to find out what it is or bother to pursue it? That's the question. Are you going to find out what God's purpose is for you? Or are you going to take matters into your own hands? You know, so easy. Boy, I've read this story a number of times, and I think about particularly there in Potiphar's house. You know, you're wealthy, you're powerful, you're basically leading this vast estate that this guy, these nobles had immense amounts of money. You can basically do whatever you want. So this old lady wants to sack out. I mean, that's only more power. You know, I mean, he basically, if he had an affair with her, well, she'd be in his debt. I mean, you know, it's not like God has given me any reason to be faithful to his way. Oh, yeah, he could have gone for it right there. And there's those times, there's those situations where it's just like, you know, why should I hold on to my integrity and be faithful to God now? Look at how, where's he for me? Why should I be there for him? And a lot of people actually make the decision at that point to bag their relationship with God and say, I'm going to go it on my own. I don't believe that God's purpose for me is real anymore. Of course, if you do that, then you miss this wonderful chance to see something in your life like what Joseph has had. And I believe we could have one person after another stand here tonight and tell a story that would be similar to Joseph's in the sense that I went through this dark night of the soul where it seemed like everything was lost. It seemed like I was forsaken of God, and I hung in there. And then now I start to realize that was God's biggest pattern of blessing for my life. I would be the first in line to testify exactly that. And people that stand in there with God and finally realize his purpose are so happy that they did that. People that bag out and walk away from God at that point, often you can run into those people decades later and they're full of regret. They know that they blew it pitifully at the time in their life. It wouldn't stand fire. So what are we to do? I got a couple of suggestions just in closing here. First of all, you need to offer your heart to Christ tonight so you can begin your own relationship with God. Like I notice a lot of people on the street today that you talk to have this belief that, well, you know, whatever happens, it's for the good. Hear people saying that? That's not necessarily true. There is a promise like that in the Bible, but it has to do with them that love God and are called according to his purpose. Actually, there's a lot of tragedies that go on in the earth that have no point or a rhyme or reason, or just pure tragic events. So tragic because they don't do anyone any good and they just destroy life. Truthfully, a lot of the negative things happening in your life may have no rhyme or reason because you haven't opened a relationship with God. That's the first step. You've got to get in there and have that personal relationship with God. Christ offers this as a free gift. It's not like you have to do anything to get it. You tell God, I'm opening myself to you. I give my heart to you tonight. And I want the death of Christ to set things right between you and I. And I'm trusting that. That's it. And God says, to anyone who comes to me, I will in no wise cast them out. No matter what you've done or who you are, God says, I'll take everyone that comes to me through the death of Christ. Then too, some of us already did that. We may need to rethink our posture relative to God tonight, just in light of this story. What if something is happening in our life that's analogous to what happened to Joseph and Jacob and the guys there? What if I've been really feeling sorry for myself in my life, and I haven't been trusting God with my life? And the fact of the matter is that I suspect that God might have abandoned me and forsaken me, and yet I may be on the verge of the opening where I see, wait a minute, he's been at work this whole time. And I would just plead to you, take the lesson from Joseph and recommit your life to God and say, God, I'm not going to doubt you and I'm not going to abandon you because I know and I believe that you have not abandoned me. Jesus says, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. That's his promise. We have to believe that. And that means absorbing and taking at times some severe trials in our lives without, you know, coming out with an attitude and breaking fellowship with God over it. But continuing to trust him through that. And that's really the lesson of the story of Joseph. Well, that's it for Genesis. Well, there's a couple more chapters, but I'm tuckered out here. And I just don't, I think that we've been through all of the major stories really in the book. So we're just going to fizzle out right there. And next week, we'll have time to get into a new study, 1 Thessalonians. I think you'll really like this small book of the New Testament. And I think within the next 6 weeks or so, we can just study this whole book and you'll have one of the really interesting New Testament books down. All right, I'm going to take some comments and questions here. How about right over here?
This is a wonderful story about, you know, just not knowing what, you know, God has in store for us at times. And a lot of times he has a plan for us beyond what we can see. About 4 years ago, I was living in one of the Christian ministry houses that this church has down on campus. And I remember a bunch of new guys had just moved into our house straight out of high school. And I didn't know them that well. They didn't know me that well. And we didn't get along very well. And there's a lot of conflict there. And I tried to initiate consistently with some of the newer guys in our house, but it just wasn't working out. And it was very frustrating. And I didn't have many friendships, really good friendships at the time. And our home church had just split, and I'd lost some friendships there too. So I was like, I was very frustrated and very, it just was one of those situations where I didn't see any good that was happening. And it was the only time I was really tempted to just leave, you know, the Christian walk behind. You know, I was in college and, you know, the whole party lifestyle, you know, maybe I could go out to some parties, maybe I could try dating around, maybe I could try that. I kind of thought, you know what, I know that people say that it'll hurt later, but I want some good feelings now. And I can remember sitting in our kitchen and I was talking to our house leader and I was just like, I just don't understand why I initiate with people and they're just not responding. And I just didn't understand what was going on. And I don't remember what he said, but I remember that I just kind of thought, you know what, maybe God has a plan for this beyond what's happening now. And I decided, well, I'm going to stick it out. I'm going to continue to move on. And God blessed those relationships, and some of my best friendships that I've ever had have come from those guys that lived there at that time. And I lived it with them for about 3 more years. So
I had a similar experience myself when my marriage was terrible. In the early years of our marriage, we absolutely despaired, my wife and I. And I'm sure that most people in that situation probably would have gotten divorced, because we couldn't relate and felt that we probably had married the wrong person or something, you know. We didn't know what to think, but we definitely felt like God was not blessing our marriage. And we had anticipated that he would, and it just wasn't happening. And that went on for some years, actually, for a number of years. So you just get to this point of darkness. I quit talking to God. I was so upset. I just felt I was angry at God, really. And I just even quit talking to him for a long time. It was all I could do to pray at all. But my wife actually had more faith about it than I did. She suggested at a couple of points. I remember one night we wept together, the two of us. And she made the comment that, well, I just wonder if this is all happening to us, you know, because God is going to use this somehow to make us become these, like, people who can help other people in their marriages and or something like that. And I'd just sit there and be like, I'm not there. I felt like she's ahead of me there, you know. At least she's thinking those kind of thoughts. I was mad. You know, and thank the Lord that for some reason we just decided to stay with it. And God did such an amazing work there. And I've had such a wonderful marriage and family. And it's just been it's turned into the kind of the center glow that my life revolves around, you know. And if I had broken with what I knew God wanted at that time, I hate to think where my life would have gone. I hate to think about it. Yeah.
Well, I've been at one of those points various times for the past, or several times throughout the past, you know, 7 or 8 years or so. And, you know, I just can't imagine doing that without the love and the support of some of the guys in my home church who have been there to, you know, they listen to me bitch and complain about things, but they've also spoken the truth to me. And it's just so key and important to have these relationships. And I'm just so thankful for the home churches here and the love and support that I've received through these guys.
We do have it made in that regard, don't we? Poor old Joseph was all by himself down there in that jail. I don't know. I don't think I would have made it. But the thing is, when we have the body of Christ, when we have the community of believers around us, it seems to give us a strength that we never had before. And we should draw on that, because that is part of God's will for us, to get us through. Anything else? All right, how about over here?
I just want to say thank you. You've really blessed me tonight. So the Spirit is definitely moving through you. I just want to confirm that.
Thank you.
I am so blessed by this body here. I've had circumstances in my life that probably would have put the, well, I'm not normal, but perhaps put someone over the edge. And in recommitting my life to the Lord a few months ago, God has been faithful, even when I couldn't be, and brought me up out of something I could not even see at the top of the mountain. But Tim McDaniel, if you're sitting over there, you'll understand. Just been blessed, and I've argued with God, I've yelled at him, I've cried and sobbed my heart out, and he continually reaffirms to me that I cannot do it, but he is going to do it if I yield. Mm-hmm. So I never thought I'd say this, but I do love the discipline of the Lord, and I appreciate your word, and I'm so encouraged. It kind of brings my faith to another level, that God is continuing. It doesn't stop here. Okay, that's not fixed. But now we're going to move you here. And who's going to be affected? So thanks.
Well, thanks for sharing that. That is, boy, yeah, that's really the way it is. And when you do, like you say, recommit your life to the Lord and just decide, I'm going to go through. If I'm, you know, it's kind of like I told the Lord when I first committed my life to him, I was in jail at the time, and I told him, if I'm washing toilets here for the next 10 years, it's going to be in your name. That's the way you got to be. And God responds, that's what he's looking for, is just that, will you trust me with your life? And it's surprising, even the difficulties and trials that we go through seem like they're so much easier at that point, because we're not struggling on ourself with them, but there's just that power of God there to help us. So thanks for sharing that. All right, one more.
I think my favorite part of the story is where Joseph wept, where he really experienced forgiveness. I mean, everything he had gone through, all the losses he experienced, in the moment that he revealed who he was to his brothers, he forgave, he was freed from all of that. And to me, it was very touching that it moved him so, that he still loved them, even after they had done what they had done.
Yeah, and you can tell, can't you, that this bitterness that could have taken him over, just the way he reacts to them, you can tell that he's had forgiveness there instead of hate. And there's a lesson for us there too. That would have been, that kind of bitterness can ruin your life. And if we don't learn to forgive, and we won't learn to forgive unless we receive forgiveness from God, become forgiven people, that's what empowers us to forgive others. Well, we're running late, so why don't we just pray together for a little while. Heavenly Father, what an awesome tale this is of your faithfulness. And we realize that we can trust you also, just like Joseph did. We need the courage, God, to really to have that kind of faith and not to doubt you, God, when these possibly severe trials close in on us. We pray for that tonight, God. Give us your perspective on life. We admit there's a lot that you're engaged in that we don't understand at this point. But we trust that we're going to understand it later
And we're going to stand with you in the meantime, Lord.
I pray too, God, for any sitting with us here tonight who may not know you in a personal way, but who may realize I need to have God in my life. And Lord, I would just pray that they would turn to you right at this moment in their heart and just say, God, I open my heart to you. And I do want to have this personal relationship with you. I do receive the death of Christ as applying to me. Count me in on what he did. And begin this walk of faith and trust in you. I want to know what that is. We thank you, God, for each man and woman in this room that prayed that tonight. In Christ's name, amen.